So let's talk about the kind of ugly side of VC. The ratio of opportunities presented to White Star, but also to a number of other funds that I've said it publicly, and the number of deals that we'll do is 100 to 1. I will say no to an investment 99% of the time. So just keep that in mind as you eventually someday do a pitch to a VC and you get that no. It's not you, it's me. It's just simply, it's a funnel issue, right? If you have 1,000 companies pitching you every year and you have a capacity to do the deals, finding the right one at the right point in its kind of growth cycle, where you actually believe in the team and you actually believe in the market, where you actually don't necessarily already have a conflict, another company in the space, where it's the right timing because you're not doing three other deals in parallel and your headspace allows you to go focus on that deal and do the due diligence. All those things coming together will only happen 1 in 100 times. And this stat has been reported by a number of funds in the US, Passion Capital in London, Seedcamp has similar stats. So it's not only us. In general, that's the gist of it. Most of the opportunities that come to us come directly through our website, and we have never invested in a company that came through our website. Too much noise, right? I'm getting too many emails from opportunities for me to actually, in a way, signal that email is important. It might be that I actually missed a couple opportunities that way, but it's the reality. If anything, another entrepreneur that I know referring a startup, an angel investor that I respect referring a startup, is somebody that another investor that might have done an earlier round saying, hey, this company's rocking, you should look at them for the next round. Those are the signals that I need to actually check out that email from the 1,000 that I got that year and say, actually, let me go deeper and look at it. So when you're thinking about approaching VCs, leverage the heck out of LinkedIn. Figure out which connection path can get you closer to the right person at which firm to have at least a warm lead. And there's plenty of VC bloggers who actually attest to this. A cold lead is usually going to lead to an almost immediate no. It's just a signal to noise ratio of like how we can interpret the amount of requests coming in. And in Europe, what is actually even less early stage funders is even more acute because the amount of people trying to raise and the number of people that can fund them is even less. So let's go inside my head for a sec and share with you like the things that are going through my head as you give me your pitch deck. And you're massively passionate about your idea. I can see it in your eyes. You've been living this idea for the last year, and you can't wait to tell me about it. And as you flip through the slides, I'm thinking, is the market big enough? So there's an example here of a company that's not my specialty. I don't have a pet, but there's a company in the U.S. called Dog Vacay that some friends of ours actually funded at the early stage. I don't have a pet. I didn't know there's actually so much pain when you go out of town to get somebody to sit your dog and how much money actually gets spent on dog sitting. Dog Vacay is doing pretty well. They raised $12 million last year. They've created a fantastic marketplace of pet owners and people who are willing to take care of your pet for a couple of dollars and massively undercuts the professional market. And it's created this vibrant community actually around people who want to lend their pets out and people want to take care of them. I didn't think it was big enough. What do I know? Can this team pull it off? And this is probably the most critical piece, especially at early stage, right? You're as much betting on the team as you're betting on the business. Do they have the complementary skills between technical and business across the co-founding team to actually go pull it off? Single founder startups are really hard for me to get comfortable with. There's too much risk in one individual. So I usually like to see a business, it can be two technical co-founders or a business founder and a technical co-founder, but somebody can at least bounce off each other and scale out the business. Because the guy who's coding is not the guy who's supposed to be selling or fundraising. It doesn't work. He's supposed to be coding, or she. Have they scaled a business before? The answer to this is usually no for early stage startups. You know, most of them are first-time entrepreneurs. But that will actually be a very positive signal if they actually scaled out a business, their own or somebody else's in the past. Can they build what they're trying to build? Do they have the technical chops to pull off the vision they have? I'm fine with outsourcing development at an early stage, finding a design studio or some guy in Poland or Ukraine to actually build your minimum viable product. But at some point, you need to own the tech inside the stack. You need to actually be able to control the destiny of your product. So at least give me guidance into the path on how you go hire that technical team once you get funding. Are there other better funded competitors out there? Probably the answer will be yes. So help me feel comfortable as to why you have an angle and an edge. And then who else can I partner with to de-risk? traditionally, VCs will actively look to syndicate deals with complementary VC funds, with other people that can step in and add different value, with angels that might have experience that help out. In a way, it's a way for us not to be the only one holding the bag when things are not going well. And secondly, it's a way for us to actually nurture the ecosystem jointly by actually bringing people into one deal who might bring us into another deal later on. It's amazing how clubby we all compete for the same deals, and yet it's very clubby in how we try to collaborate. And actually, three of my most recent investments have actually come through other angels or VCs who brought us into the opportunity. So let me quickly walk through a couple examples of businesses that I've invested in and how I answer those questions as I was going through it. So first one's called Kimi. It's based in the US. I think it's brilliant, of course. I invested in it. But what you do is you take your phone and you take your key. You put your key on a white piece of paper. You take a picture of the key with your phone on both sides, and the algorithm will create a digital version of your key. It figures out, based on image recognition, the heights of the ridges and the length. So now it knows what your key looks like. And once it knows what your key looks like, you can order a copy with your favorite Chelsea colors and pay $6.99 for it. But more importantly, if you're locked out of your house, it now provides insurance for you to get unlocked. You can go to a locksmith and show them effectively a locksmith code on the app that tells them how to cut the key. Or you can go to a 7-Eleven in New York City and find this little guy here, which is a robotic kiosk. The kiosk inside has a magazine full of keys. It supports 90% of the US keys house keys and mailbox keys. So you show up with your app, which has a code, your credit card, and your fingerprint, and you can actually print out your house key if you're locked out. And trust me, you're completely price insensitive at that point. In New York, average lockout service is $250. And these guys charge $30 for the key to get copied. They have, they're rolling out 100 kiosks across the US, and the idea is to build out thousands of kiosks. And the margin on those keys is quite nice. But what I love about this is it's a massive market. It's actually locksmith, lockout, and car keys in the US is $8 billion. Yeah. Massively fragmented, some guy in a corner shop that's taking my key and copying it. And no technical disruption. So these guys use image recognition, robotics, price sensitivity analysis based on user to figure out what price they're going to give you. So some cool tech to actually make your life more convenient. So they use, back to my thesis slide, the combination of computing power on the cloud for their image recognition with this data around the consumer, and then just cool robot key cutters to actually make your key. And effectively, it's a quid pro quo on convenience and money parting hands. So as I went through the questions, I actually found them on a blog, to be honest. I was doing research on 3D printing, and I came across them. Turns out a friend of mine had been an angel investor. He introduced us. We ended up leading the $7 million Series A that they raised. Is the market big enough? Yes, and massively fragmented. Can this team pull it off? Well, the CTO is a PhD in robotics. They have employees from NASA, from Lockheed Martin, from Raytheon, guys with like robotics and data analytics components. Yes. Had they scaled a team before? No, never. The CEO is a former financial analyst, and the CTO used to be in a PhD in a lab. So that's where hopefully we come in and we can help them scale out. Do they have the technical chops to pull it off? Absolutely. Are there better funded competitors? Yeah, there's a couple of other VC-funded companies doing similar stuff, but with kind of older technology that haven't innovated as much. So I'd say it's still a pretty open market, and it's pretty darn large. So there can be two or three competitors there. And then who do I partner with to de-risk it? And I think the one call that convinced me to do this deal was when I called 7-Eleven. So 7-Eleven has a venture arm that invests in companies. And 7-Eleven Ventures, the guy who runs the fund, was saying, yeah, listen, they've been inside the 7-Eleven shops. We love it. It's performing really well. We look at kiosk businesses all the time. This is one of the better performing ones. Like, oh, that's really good. And by the way, who inside 7-Eleven gets to decide how many you buy and which stores you put them into? He's like, that would be me. So the guy who was effectively the decision maker for a key partner was also going to pony up a big check to be part of the round. The other de-risking was the non-executive member of the board created this kiosk business. He had a business called Coinstar, where you took your loose change, you put it into the Coinstar, and it gave you cash, and they kept a couple of cents per transaction. Coinstar is now a $2 billion publicly traded company in the US called Outerwall. So the CEO, the founder of Coinstar, is on the board with us. He kind of knows the kiosk business pretty well. That was another kind of nudge that it was the right people around the table to go do it. It's a hard business. It's effectively they have to go pay a lot of money to build these kiosks and ship them out. But it's really appealing combination of real world, kind of physical, nitty-gritty, ugly locksmith marketplace with brilliant technology. Another one was a seed investment that we just did in London. If you ever go to London and you want to go to a concert, download the app. It's called Dice. It's a mobile ticketing app for concerts. And it has a curated set of concerts that you can actually browse through and select. And everybody, well, most people, I don't know about you guys, most people hate Ticketmaster. Ticketmaster charges you 12% booking fees just because. The artist doesn't see that. It hurts the fans. There's no data shared from Ticketmaster back to the, or very little back to the artists. They're flying blind, effectively. And yet, Live Nation and Ticketmaster has a $5.4 billion valuation. And they control something like 67% of all tickets sold around the world. So there's a lot of people trying to disrupt Ticketmaster, coming at it from different angles. What we liked about these guys is that they actually came from the music space. Phil, the CEO, used to manage a bunch of electronic acts. He created it because of his own frustration as a manager. They launched the app here. It had the biggest TechCrunch write-up I've ever seen. It was 5 pages long. You can actually download the app now. You can buy tickets. And their vision is to create a more frictionless way for the fans to go to concerts. There's no booking fees. There's this kind of convenience services like waiting lists. The tickets are sold out. Do you want tickets? Yes. Get yourself on the waiting list for two. Or they're working on some other things in which you could have convenience to actually make sure that you get to go to the concerts you want to go to. And by the way, there's actually a whole bunch of data being captured on you and your music taste, which can be shared with the managers on the back end, which actually give them some insight as to who the heck wants to go to their concerts and where. So is the market big enough? Yes, but you know, kind of going up against Ticketmaster is a hard thing. Can the team pull it off? The other guys behind Dice is this studio in London called Us2, which is a design studio. They're famous for a game called Monument Valley on iPad, which is featured pretty much if you go to the Apple Store and you see the iPads with a little game, that's Monument Valley. It's actually designed in London. It's awesome. So they actually took a bunch of their best guys and put it into Dice and spun it off. So they have a combination of really good tech team. The CTO is the only CTO I've ever met from Greenland, actually the only tech guy I've ever met from Greenland. Phil, who came from the music space, and the design guy from Us2. Have they scaled a team before? Absolutely not. The Us2 guys have, but Phil used to manage like acts. Do they have the technical chops to pull it off? Yes. Better funded competitors? Well, start with Ticketmaster, but yes, a number of them in the US, a number of them actually even here, Yplan, that does something similar. But I think they're coming at it from a different angle. And then who else do I partner with? The interesting thing is we're the actual only institutional investor in the round. It's people from the music industry, the managers for Arctic Monkeys and Radiohead and Robbie Williams, Metropolis, which is the second largest promoter, which gives them a huge thing in the ticketing space, supply of tickets. The hardest thing when you're creating a ticketing startup is to convince the guy who's doing the O2 show for Radiohead to give you 100 tickets, because he has the ability to allocate them, but he's going to put them in the channel that he thinks is going to sell the fastest. So because they're all investors, it also means that their acts are all flowing through the system and some pretty high-profile acts. Most of the acts on Dice, I have no idea. I'm totally apparently unhip now. But apparently they tell me it's really cool acts that you couldn't find other places. And I'll finish with this one, Blog Loving. Because this one actually challenged me in a couple of the other questions. Blog Loving started in Sweden by a 24-year-old who his girlfriend had a fashion blog. As usually happens, geeks try to impress their girlfriends by coding something. I actually coded a website for my now wife at one point. She wasn't impressed. So he coded an app to get more traffic for her blog. And by the way, it's actually the number one blog on Blog Loving now, and they're now married, so it worked. But what it does, it aggregates 1.5 million blogs around the world, mainly in fashion and lifestyle, and it has a mobile app and a website through which you consume the content on a daily basis. Instead of having to go to 100 blogs, you get it all kind of there, and I call it fashion porn. People spend 30 minutes per day just browsing the fashion updates from their favorite bloggers. And it's huge. It's grown from when we invested to now. It's now got 30 million monthly uniques from all over the world who actually literally want to just get their fashion fix. They've actually made some bloggers from scratch, people that had no traffic, that grew because of Blog Loving, and they've spent zero money on user acquisition. It's all been organic. So we invested as angels, and we saw it scale out. At that point, they were at a couple million uniques, over 30 million uniques now. Can they make money? Absolutely no idea. Nobody's really managed to figure out how to make money on blogging. I mean, Tumblr made money by selling itself, but it never actually created revenue. Blogger made money by selling itself to Google, but never really made money. So I don't know. I mean, there's some ways in which you could think about native advertising, but it's still unclear. Can the team pull it off? Well, they started from this kind of passion point, right, about the girlfriend and trying to satisfy her needs, and from that it's grown to a very vibrant community. Yes, and they've actually scaled out the team significantly in New York. So we found them in Sweden, but we knew that their market and their exit were in the U.S., so they actually moved the whole team to New York. Had they scaled a business before? Not the four 24-year-old guys in Sweden, but when they moved to New York, Matthias, the CEO, said, listen, I'm the product guy. I want to go build products. I don't want to be dealing with you investor guys or doing financial reports. Let me build products. So we actually found a fantastic CEO. She actually ran North America for Daily Motion. Had worked at MTV Networks, was an operating partner at a venture capital firm, had worked at AOL. She knew how to scale up media businesses, and she came on board, and she was actually a very passionate user of the product herself. So she's scaled that business before. Do they have the technical chops to pull it off? Yes. Better funded competitors? Depends what you call a competitor. I don't know, Instagram is well funded by Facebook, Pinterest, Flipboard. It depends on where you think your users will be end up consuming media. And then, no, who can I partner with to actually pull this off? Betaworks, which is a company that we invested in and co-invest with in New York, that's focused around the kind of the new evolution of media. And then Nordzone, who's a Swedish fund that was the first backer for Spotify, who knows how to build effectively world-class global media companies. And they came in for the round. They raised $7 million, which we actually doubled up with through the fund. And at that point, it just continued to scale up. So the reason I'm actually sharing these deals is go back to the questions that I posed earlier and how I question myself as I'm going through your pitch. I did not answer yes to every single question in every investment that I made. Actually, in some cases, I answered no to a bunch of the questions. But enough of the other questions and enough of actually kind of the composition of the deal made me feel comfortable that betting on this, taking a risk on this opportunity made sense. So try to figure out what the questions that that individual investor is going to have and try to figure out how you make your pitch in a way personalized, right? You should never actually have the same pitch for every investor or angel you're going to go pitch. Everybody has their own angle. Do some research, read their blogs, read their tweets, talk to other people that have actually might have gotten investment from them before. Try to figure out if they're the right investor for you, because VC actually taking money from VCs is ridiculous. It's effectively Tinder for like effectively a 7-year relationship. You have 3 meetings and you kind of talk to each other. You think you like each other. He gives you this really big legal document that you're supposed to understand and sign, in which he says he's going to take 20% of your firm, sit on your board, have rights over you, have the ability to fire you, by the way. And you're supposed to decide in 2 weeks whether you want to be married to this person for the next 7 years. Average VC investment lasts longer in the U.S. than the average marriage in the U.S. And so the fact that we do this at like speed dating rate is sometimes scary. And it's also an information asymmetry. I've done a lot more deals than you have as an entrepreneur, right? I do probably one a month. You probably will do 2-3 in your life. So that information asymmetry is actually really hard. So A, get some good advice, i.e. a good lawyer. B, read all the books out there about VC funding. Brad Feld has one of the best ones. Effectively demystifies a term sheet on behalf of the entrepreneur and explains why some things like clawbacks and ratchet are bad words. And just before you hit the road, kind of be ready to actually tackle that information asymmetry and this kind of this speed dating model you're about to enter.